I was born in a small town called Masjid Suleiman in southern Iran.
I was born in Syria.
I was born in Hamburg, Germany.
I was born in Kuwait.
I was born in Tanzania in a refugee camp.
I was born in Singapore.
Guatemala.
I'm from Ireland.
I was born in Thailand refugee
I was born in Mumbai.
I was born in Vientiane, Laos.
I was born in England.
I was born in Costa Rica.
Welcome to Many Roads to Hear in Conversation. In this series, we find Oregon authors and experts to talk together and shed light on critical and timely issues. Through these conversations, we aim to deepen our understanding of the experiences and stories that shape our communities and our nation. I'm your host, Meg Ritter. In conversation today are Eliza Canty Jones, Chief Program Officer at the Oregon Historical Society and editor of the Oregon Historical Quarterly, and Erica Nato Campbell, the author of Portland's Audacious Champion, How Bill Nato Overcame Anti-Japanese Hate and Became an Intrepid Civic Leader. Bill Nato was arguably one of Portland's most influential business and civic leaders. Drive down Nato Parkway along Portland's Waterfront Park, visit the Japanese American Historical Plaza, or glimpse a view of the iconic Portland, Oregon sign near Burnside Bridge. These are just a few of the numerous preservations and improvements Bill brought to the city. Erica is not only Bill's biographer, but also his granddaughter. And in today's episode, she speaks with Eliza about her grandfather's influence and legacy in Portland, yes, but also about his lesser-known story. As a second-born son, growing up, Bill felt overlooked and ignored by his parents. During World War II, when Bill was a teenager, his family fled Portland to avoid the Japanese internment camps. After his high school graduation, Bill enlisted in the U.S. Army and served in occupied Japan before eventually resettling in Portland. In exploring his story, Erica gains a deeper understanding of her beloved grandfather, the public figure and the private man, and his history. But ultimately, she gains a greater understanding of herself, what she wants for future generations, and what she hopes for Portland now.
I'm Eliza Canty Jones, and I'm here with Erica Nato Campbell.
Hello.
You say Nato, not Nido?
Correct. My grandfather Americanized the pronunciation in the 1950s. But yes, traditionally in Japan, it is pronounced Naito. I have never been a Naito in my life.
You've always been a Naito.
And I didn't even know that was an option until my grandfather passed away. And my great uncle Sam started referring to himself as Naito. And I said to my mom, what is wrong with Uncle Sam? And she, clued me in. Well, actually, Erica, that's how you pronounce our name.
You've talked some in talking about the book that you've just written about your grandfather, Bill Nato, see, now I'm messing up, who we're here to talk about. But you have talked about growing up and not realizing our family's Japanese, we're Japanese American, that this came somehow later in your life, that you learned that. Can you talk some about when you learned that and what that meant to you and what sort of exploring that has been like for you?
The first time I really started to feel Japanese American was probably around 2009 when the Japanese American Museum of Oregon was doing an exhibit about Bill and Sam, and I was helping doing the research, and I realized my grandfather didn't speak English until first grade. I was never taught that as a kid, and he was the ultra-American. And even though he's visually ultra-Japanese, I never saw that in him, which I think is probably strange from an outsider perspective. The moment where I felt genuinely Japanese was when I went to Japan after the Great Tohoku earthquake. It's hard to explain. I don't believe in supernatural things, but I just stepped off the plane and I was just, part of my blood just felt warm. Like there's a part of me that's supposed to be here. I never felt that before. at the same time, I was like, I am not meant to be here because I am an American, right? And there's a certain level of homogeneity where I was like, I couldn't be here forever. The sacrifice of individualism. And of course, my grandfather was the ultimate American individual, you know, the bootstraps, defining yourself on your own terms, changing your name so that you are separate from what came before. I look at his experience as the quintessential experience of what it means to be second generation. You know, in Japanese American community, we call that nisei, but the struggle of having parents who are wholly Japanese. His mother never learned English. She didn't want him to marry an American woman. She accepted when Sam married a Japanese American woman, like that was the okay, fine. But she I don't think she actually liked America very much. And so he is being born as an American citizen. He's growing up in an all-white neighborhood. That is his conception of self. But then he has the draw of his mom and his dad being pretty much 100% Japanese. And how do you define yourself? I mean, Japanese culture is so traditional. The family is sacrosanct. Your father is sacrosanct. Like, how do you balance defining yourself, not wanting to disappoint them, but wanting to keep your American friends who don't have the first clue what Japan is about? Learning his history was learning my history. My editor suggested that we eliminate the first chapter, which is not about Bill, but it's about Japan and the place where his parents were coming from. And she said, you could probably drill this down to a page at the beginning of the chapter about Bill being born. And I said, no, I really can't because people don't understand the history of Japan very well. And to understand Bill's motivation and how he lived and his drive to be different, to be defined by something else, you have to know the something else he was comparing himself to. And that's his parents' background. And also, I told her, I said, a lot of white people read this book and I have them captive. And so I want to do a little education that they may not get.
That was me. I mean, I know Oregon history better than most people, like above average Oregon history knowledge. But reading that chapter, opening the book that way for me, I was like, oh, it grounded me totally differently from the story than something I would expect to be grounded in, right? Like you could have grounded the story in 19th century exclusion in Oregon. But yeah, so for me as a reader, thank you. How have you continued to get to know him better, even without him being here through all of this?
So my grandfather died when I was about to turn 16. So I never got to be an adult with him. I was always very precocious, and I feel like I wasn't a child a lot of the time, but to be an actual equal in terms of we're both adults, we have lived experiences, those conversations, I never got to have those with him. I've given multiple talks where somebody who knew Bill was in the audience. And many times afterward, people have come up to me with tears in their eyes and just said, thank you. He impacted them so deeply. And often I have no idea who they are. Bill gave so many people that feeling of joy, that feeling of self-belief, of endless opportunity. He really made you feel like $1 million. He had felt so awful as a kid that he understood how precious it was to have somebody show faith in you and show belief in you. And he knew how powerful it was because when he finally got it, I mean, look what he was able to accomplish. And so he looked at every person as, if I just give you this little push, this little pat on the back, what will you be able to accomplish when I imbue you with that self-belief? He wasn't good with his kids with that, but he was very good with me with that and so many others. And I wish there was a way that I could talk to every single person he did that to, but that book would be, you know, like a Proustian epic.
So you have to know that there were dozens of people who told this same kind of story to know, yes, this is a pattern, this is a characteristic. I can say definitively that this is an example of something he did time and time and time and time again. But it's a bummer to only be able to choose one or two of those examples.
There were employees who played a really big part on the retail side. And my editor, you know, she talked to me and she said, I'm not sure this is advancing the story that people want to hear. People don't associate him with the retail and wholesale, even though it was a huge part of what he did and the money he made initially. It's the real estate and it's the philanthropy and it's the civic engagement. Real estate was his passion. Urban trees were his passion. He was good at retail in the sense that he knew how to penny pinch, maximize what they had, but it wasn't his passion. Because the other thing is, in the real estate stories, I'm telling about his trauma. I'm telling about what's driving him. Almost every building has something behind it. None of the retail stores have that.
So can you just put us in the Galleria with you as a kid and what it was like to be there and how that helped you get to know your grandfather, both in the moment and in reflecting on it later?
Let's take 1985. I'm 5 years old. My grandma is the manager of the building, my grandma Mickey. So she has an office on the fourth floor. And my mom is the marketing manager. And so if I wasn't at the YWCA Montessori, I was in the offices. It was really still bustling back then. You know, all the stores in the Galleria were entrepreneurs, small business owners. And then on the fourth and fifth floors, there were architects, graphic designers, and then a bunch of nonprofits. I would also get sent there. So like if I was being a problem, which means just being a kid with energy, they would say like, go down to NARAL and stuff envelopes. Go down to the Peace Institute and see if they need your help making posters. I mean, literally just do anything but bother us. But they were sending me to places that were sharing values with me and also teaching me the value of giving back. I don't remember them ever telling me war was bad, but I do remember telling me go help the Peace Institute. And all of those nonprofits, they weren't money makers. And so my grandma often had to, you know, can we go a little easy on that lease, or it's okay if you're late because I support what you're doing. And of course, everything she did had to be okayed by my grandpa because he literally had to okay every single thing. Everything my grandma's doing, my grandpa is watching. The thing that was great about the Galleria is it was communal. It was Oregon. It was Portland in the same way that, so what they did it in Old Town in the 70s, and then they did it in the Galleria where you're trusting Oregonians to know what other Oregonians want.
I don't think I realize the significance of your grandmother managing the Galleria. You know, why did she build that community the way she did?
My grandmother started working at the Galleria because she got tired of feeling excluded from dinner table talk because my grandfather only talked about the business. And so for her to know anything that was going on, she had to get out there. She was an incredibly independent, modern woman. She's from Canada, or I say she was from Canada. And she only became an American citizen so she could vote for McGovern against the Vietnam War. That's who she was. And she wrote this incredible letter to the editor of the Oregonian after there were some protests against the Vietnam War. And there was an article that came out about it. And she wrote this scathing rebuke of the Oregonian's coverage and saying it was a peaceful demonstration. Like, you picked on the two people who did, you know, something borderline not okay, and you exploded it to make it seem like the anti— I mean, I was like, oh, group. She was incredible. She did not like that I had an entire chapter about her. She didn't feel she was important enough to warrant an entire chapter. And she didn't tell me no, but she kind of side-eyed me like, why are you doing this? That was another one where my editor said, you know, we could trim this big time. And I said, no, you can't.
It's interesting to think about, you know, this work you've done to understand your grandfather, of course, means you've had to understand a lot of other people in your family. How did doing this research and writing this book make you think differently about your mom?
I didn't understand how traditionally Japanese my family really was in certain ways until I started researching Grandpa. In a Japanese family, you want a firstborn son. That is the end-all, be-all. Everything else that happens after that is whatever. But the firstborn son is the most important thing. If you get a second son, that's great. He's a backup. But if you get a daughter, it's irrelevant. She's helpful to the house because you're not supposed to have your sons learn how to do the dishes or make food or do the laundry. And so if you have a daughter, she fills that role. You know, my grandfather was a bad father. No one would disagree with me. But then you look at why. You know, there's something called the imprinting phase between 3 and 8, where you subconsciously absorb what it means to love, to hate, to show anger, to show affection. If your parents are teaching you that, and if they don't understand they're teaching you that, you can learn a lot of bad ideas about how to show love. So then I can look at my mom and be like, well, what did she learn to show it to me, right? And that's where intentionality comes in. My son, my firstborn son, I was very intentional. I was not going to be that stoic Japanese-English-Canadian combo, which turns out to be quite a deadly combo for showing emotions. I hugged him all the time. I kissed him all the time. I just constantly touching him to show my affection because I had never seen it. I hadn't experienced it. But it starts in Japan. It starts in Newcastle, England.
You knew you were loved by your grandfather.
He hugged me all the time. Grandma hugged me all the time. They had all these nicknames for me. My grandfather was a terrible sleeper. He would sleep anywhere all the time. So they'd have front row tickets to the symphony or the theater, and he would be sound asleep. And he had a terrible snore from smoking cigars. I mean, imagine you're watching Hamlet, and this man is sawing logs in the front row. And so my grandma would kick him out. And then he would go sleep on a bench in the lobby. So she finally decided, you don't get to come at all. So I got to go. And I got to sit in the front row. And Grandma and I would go to the Heathman and have fancy dinner and then go to the theater. There wasn't this stress to raise me. And like, I existed just kind of in this beautiful place grandchildren do, where you just get to do all the fun stuff.
I want to go back to something you were talking about a couple minutes ago, too. Your grandfather had this childhood where he felt discarded at home. So that's a very personal, individual experience that he felt he was the second son. His mom, you say, eventually just didn't really even like him very much. That's what he felt. But then also, he was very much discarded socially and politically you know, he was a citizen of the United States of America, and the United States of America said, because of your ancestry, you belong in jail, basically, right? A concentration camp, right? He escaped that with his family, you know, by going outside of the war zone. What was that like, writing about that and trying to figure out those things together?
Bill's story is very different if he had a very loving family with total acceptance. And then you have Executive Order 9066 with the federal government. And of course, the mayor of Portland, the governor of Oregon saying, amen, get them out of here, right? You have this collective decision by the community to say, we don't want you. If you look at Sam, Bill's brother, he was the chosen, the firstborn son. He got every advantage. And his experience is markedly different. He still was hurt by Executive Order 9066, but he almost, I almost want to say it was a speed bump to him because he had so much self-confidence. Bill just never had that moment. So his parents don't want him. America doesn't want him. Well, America wants him enough to draft him to throw his body at the Germans, Italians, or the Japanese. They want him for that. So he goes over to Japan. And here in America, he's being told, you're Japanese. You're not American. You're Japanese. Well, he goes to Japan. And if you know anything of Japan, you are not Japanese if you're a Japanese American. You may speak it fluently. You may know how to make the best sushi rice on God's green earth, but you are not Japanese. So he goes there, and they're nice to him, but that's not a place he can go either. So he is literally floating in purgatory. I don't belong, and nobody wants me. That trauma just keeps feeding itself. I always tell people, trauma gets paid. He had to become the most important person in Portland, Oregon, and that wasn't enough. He had to keep becoming more and more important because that trauma was getting paid.
You know, I just imagine him looking around at the city and seeing all of these, you know, real physical changes to the city that are, as you say in the exhibit at Japanese American Museum of Oregon, because of Bill. So he could look and see trees that were planted and buildings that existed and entrepreneurs whose businesses were thriving. And I think about how satisfying that must have been and how joyful sometimes that must have been, because these were also ideas that he loved. He did the things that he wanted to see and that he wanted to exist. One of the most devastating parts of your book for me is the chapter near the end where he's working to build the memorial to incarceration on the waterfront. And all of these political leaders who have accepted his advice, who have invited him to rooms and tables, who have appreciated his money, try and stop him from doing this. That just makes me so mad. What do they not want to remember? I don't know. What does that story mean to you? Or how did you think about him deciding to do this work, to say, no, there will be a physical place in this city where we think about this? And what does that do for the bad trauma by that point? I don't know. Am I taking this story too hard?
No. Okay. First of all, no. Let me give you a current example. It's starting to be March, which is climate change, but it used to be April. The cherry blossoms would start to pop open, and you see it on every news station. Oh, my gosh, come down to Tom McCall Waterfront Park. That's not where the cherry blossoms are. They are in the Japanese American Historical Plaza, which is a part of Tom McCall Waterfront Park. But that idea, that impulse to put the white name ahead of the Asian name, is ingrained in Portland's marrow. That's what he's fighting against. And in Portland, the racism is very quiet, where we try to be very kind to your face. We're not very direct. If we have an issue with you, if we do bring it up, it's super oblique and you have to like, no, what are you saying here? And that makes us feel safer in our racism because people don't directly do things. And so, Bill, you can't have this memorial. And they came up with bureaucratic reasons. Well, we have this fallen police memorial, and, you know, that's real important, Bill. And we don't want a memorial to something shameful. That's so negative, Bill, and you don't like negative things. They just kept saying, oh, you don't have the money. Behind all of it is we do not want Japanese faces on the waterfront.
Historians and other people really do try to work to understand the particular racism of Portland. How do you see, for your personal experience, but also as somebody who's a published author on this history, what do you see in how there's the scholarly or public understanding of Japanese American history, and what do you want to see in that?
It's always been complicated in our family that we avoided the concentration camps. There is a sense of shame that you didn't experience the suffering to the furthest extent possible. Are we really Japanese American if we weren't incarcerated? If the government took away your family's home, took away your job, took away their going to school, moving you to a place you don't even know, you spend 6 months in a livestock pavilion, who are you now? When you are in a small community defined by ethnicity, there is a shared trauma that is happening. So that even if it's not directly happening to you, the mere fact it's happening to your neighbors, to your friends and their families, has an impact on you that is almost commensurate with it happening to you. But what we know now, if you watch George Floyd being murdered and you are an African American man, you are watching yourself being murdered. That's shared trauma. My grandpa did not understand. If I said this stuff to him now, I think he would probably try to be dismissive of it because it feels a little weak. And so grandpa was such a dynamic individual. He was so charismatic that he almost stopped. I mean, his granddaughter, didn't conceptualize him as Japanese, right? He was his own thing, his own planet. But how quickly that will turn. I think the memorial was so important to him because even if he never admitted it out loud, he knew that we were always a moment away. Because that's what happened with Pearl Harbor. He literally went to bed being an American and woke up an enemy of the state, and he had slept. That is all that happened. And that's how quickly it gets taken away. Well, both my grandpas were alcoholics. Both of them were veterans of World War II. And I think we kind of want to have this idea, well, it was the good war, so all the dead bodies and all the people they killed, like it didn't impact them in some really horrible way, but it did, because humans, unlike wolves, we actually are made to feel bad about killing other humans, even when it's justified, even when it's self-defense. And that's why so many vets have trauma and PTSD. And so there you have all these young men, my grandpas included, witnessing so much death and suffering. By the time we go take over Japan, it's starving to death. All those people are starving to death. And you had the Japanese government ripping 12 and 13-year-old boys from their mother's arms to go put them in kamikaze planes at the end. You have utter devastation of an entire country. And he's witnessing that. So of course he drinks. What else is he going to do? And he even went to therapy briefly. Both my grandpas drank. They drank all day. They were never not with alcohol. It was, you know, I used to refer to them as functional alcoholics because they went to work. They were very successful. You know, my grandpa's cancers were alcohol related. What would our world be like if we let men be traumatized and then treated that trauma?
I'm thinking about your family sending you to the Peace Institute and not saying war is terrible and should be avoided at all costs. It is a brutal thing to ask people to go kill other people.
Oh.
It is, and it is stunning the frequency with which it's done. There are dehumanizations happening in many places on the planet right now. But one of the places they're happening is in Portland, and it is with people who are living in addiction or mental illness or extreme poverty or some combination of those things, and living in tents, living on the streets. You know, we don't have those SROs anymore, the single room occupancies. And how does what you've learned about how your grandfather engaged civically influence how you think about how Portland should approach that today?
So I am often asked, how would Bill Nadeau deal with the houseless crisis happening right now? I always tell the story of when Mexican heroin came into Old Town in the early 90s, and it was horrific. Before that, most of the houseless, they were what we would call winos. They drank. Heroin comes, and it is decimating the community there. And he had – the monetarism was always a weird thing to me. But in this instance, it was actually the best response, which he said, why wouldn't someone deal heroin if we can't offer them a home and we can't offer them a job and we can't offer them paths to either of those things? How can we be critical of a drug dealer when that is the only economic way to survive? He never looked at someone and said, you're homeless because you are a bad person. He never committed the fundamental attribution error. Now, I always tell people, fentanyl isn't heroin. It's very different. And he would have reacted differently, because when you see someone in a fentanyl psychosis, they are not here. You are dealing with someone who is not even remotely rational. But the same principle applies. They are not a bad person. They did not decide to become addicted to fentanyl because they're bad. Because of how much he suffered, because of how much he knew what it felt like to be on the outside, he was able to look at people with a level of understanding and empathy that I think even business leaders who shared his values couldn't understand to the depth that he could. And that allowed him to be so much more impactful because there was that level of understanding.
Would you talk some about how some of your studies at Reed and sort of as a person since then influence how you think about your grandfather?
Reed College was the self-described best time of Bill's life. He loved it there. He loved the challenge. He loved the professors. He loved rising to the occasion, which is what Reed requires. You're never allowed to phone it in because you will be embarrassed in front of your classmates. And they'll know, and your classmates will call you out. So you better read that 500-page book for that one day. I had the same experience. Reed doesn't believe that there is an answer, and he lived his life that way. I am always looking for more information. I'm always looking for new information. I'm always talking to other people. What's happening out there? he didn't think that knowledge was static. That's why he's able to do so much, because he wasn't afraid to say, I don't know. What do you think? Wow, humility. The thing that Bill valued the most and put the most trust in were the people. He believed the people of Portland knew what was best for Portland, and he trusted them. But Bill, for everything he went through, he could have hated Portland. He could have hated Portlanders. He could have come back with the fury and vengeance he felt, but been negative. And instead, he did the exact opposite, and he came from a place of empathy and forgiveness. He shared the big, empathetic heart that most people would only give to their friends. He gave that to the city.
What do you feel about Portland?
I feel that Portland is stuck in believing it's still 1984 and that we are doing all these great things and we're there. We can't get out of our own way of thinking we're better than we are. I do agree with my grandfather that Portlanders do have the ability to do great things, but we have to own reality. We have to accept the obstacles, the difficulties, and we like to pretend like we are, but we're not talking about the real obstacles. I think a lot of that has to do with not listening to people of color. And so there has to be this moment where we say, we've been letting white dudes do this for a really long time. And maybe we should let people of color take the reins. Everything that benefits them benefits white people too. You know, my grandfather never said it this way, but it's the message he was trying to say is there are enough cookies for everybody. And I've said this many times. The function of white supremacy is to trick us into believing there are very few cookies. So we should fight each other for the crumbs. There are enough cookies for everybody. There are enough cookies for everybody. And that was his message. Positive, community-led change benefits everybody. Trees on 82nd benefit me in Southwest Portland. But we need to start looking at basic core values we can all share and push for. We need to focus on foundational things. And that's what made the 70s so incredible, because we actually looked at the foundation. They didn't say, what does the city need to be for businesses and tourists? They said, Portlanders, what do you want the city to be? And then we got an incredible city out of that. We need to get back to Portlanders. What do you want the city to be? And that was Bill's message over and over. Trust the people of Portland. He trusted them to tax themselves. He trusted them over and over again to make the right choice, even though at the most critical moment in his life, they made the wrong one. Decades later, he trusts them to do the right thing. Faith.
We'll see if this new form of city government, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful about that. Maybe I'm an optimist.
but I think the thing that defined Bill was risk-taking.
Yeah.
He was not afraid to do something that hadn't been done before. We have to be willing to make mistakes. I think a great example is when we were doing the transit mall in the 70s, and everyone hated it because it was ripping up a major part of downtown. Ridership for TriMet was like 18, 20%. So it's like, oh, we're ripping up this giant thing for something. And it had gone bankrupt. It wasn't TriMet. It was the precursor went bankrupt. It's like, why are we doing all this? And they were going to put trees on it, which was a kind of newer thing for the rest of the city. Bill said, we need London planes. And the London plane was this beautiful, fast-growing tree. It looked amazing in a year, like it was a gangbuster. But it also ripped up sidewalks. It ripped up basements. And they had just spent millions of dollars to rip them out of the sidewalks in Seattle. And so the forester, the city forester, was basically like, I'm going to quit my job if you put in London planes. And Grandpa said, you have to. You have to. You have to make the transit mall as beautiful as humanly possible, as quickly as humanly possible to get public buy-in. And we know we're going to remove them in 5-6 years. It was a risk. I mean, the city forester was really angry. And literally no one else wanted it but Bill Nadeau and Bill Roberts. They ultimately, the two of them were powerful enough to get the London planes. Now people would be, oh, can you imagine the outcry, the waste of money, this idea that everything has to be perfect the first time you do it.
Or even that there is a perfect
solution.
Or that
there is a perfect.
Right? He's like, the transit mall has to last, so we have to make it beautiful immediately so that people start riding these buses, and then we can deal with the other part later. Maybe that's from being a salesman for years, right?
Well, and also, he did have an understanding of psychology. He understood because of his own experience. He was highly manipulative. There's no other word for it. He just fundamentally understood how people worked and what people want. I mean, that's why he put trees on the sidewalks in the first place when we didn't even have street trees. The thing that makes him different from today is he was not advocating for himself. He wasn't asking them to clean up the city for his buildings or for his business. He was asking for the betterment of the place he lived, the place he shared. He was a part of the community. I repeat this in my talks. He was not a wealthy landowner who came to the city to have lunch with somebody and left. He lived here. He loved it here. He wasn't above it. He was within it. That idea that every part matters, we got to get back there. We got to get back there because Bill was right. Every part did matter. And not just that they mattered to exist, but their opinion mattered. He was so damaged, but he took that damage and tried to make sure no one else went through that. Through the range of things that could happen to a human, whether it's not having a good enough job, whether it's not being listened to because you're a woman and you're the first one to lead the chamber. Right? Or because you're a street sweeper and they're not doing enough to deal with the homeless who are creating garbage. I mean, to be like Bill is to care about other people and to try with whatever you can to make their lives a little bit better.
It's so different from bootstraps, right? Because I'm thinking about him encouraging other entrepreneurs. It was still them doing it, but they weren't doing it alone. They're doing it with his encouragement, with his energy, with his faith in their ability. And that is powerful to have somebody else believe in you and see you.
You know, money's great, but like, would my grandfather have traded millions of dollars to have had parents who surrounded him with love and support? How many of us would make that choice? He would have been a totally different person. How many of us would be different people if we had the love and support at home that he gave out to everybody else? Again, this is faith in Portlanders. I don't need to do your job for you because I know you can do it if I just remind you. If I just remind you. That you can do it. He was a notorious fibber. And there was a lot of false bravado, but you know what? People bought it and then it became real. He was everybody's coach. including the entire city of Portland.
Are there places in Portland that you go where you feel him more than others?
My backyard, which was his backyard. I love trees and I love nature the way he did. And I have trees that he planted that are ginormous. Anytime I'm having a tough time, my backyard, which is his backyard, nature will send me an owl. She will send me a Cooper's hawk. Because she knows, because he loved that forest. He nurtured it. He spent more time in it than with his children when they were growing up. And so I hug my trees, which sounds cheesy, but I do. And I tell them I love them. And I remind myself that something you do that seems very small can make something eternal. That's where I feel him the most.
Erica, you have given so many gifts through this book and all the times that you have talked to people individually and in public about it. It's an incredible labor to create that. I am certain that you will never know all of the people that you have influenced by taking the time and putting the work in with the care that you have to tell this story of your grandfather and his influence on you and our city and so much more. So I just want to say thank you.
Thanks, Eliza.
Thank you.
No crying in the podcast.
Many Roads to Hear is a production of The Immigrant Story. This episode was hosted, produced, and edited by me, Meg Ritter. Storyboard was edited by Fran Silverman, with audio post-production by Greg Palmer. The original interview was conducted by our executive producer, Sankar Raman, in October of 2024. Thank you to St. Andrew Lutheran Church in Beaverton, Oregon, for the use of their space to record the interview. This episode is made possible by the generous support by the Marie Lamfrum Charitable Foundation. For more stories, visit theimmigrantstory.org/manyroads. Listen live at prp.fm or stream us wherever you get your podcasts.